Welcome to Denkoe Sesshin. Transmitting the light as the light changes in the season. We just had the equinox, the time of equal light. And now, almost imperceptibly, the light seems to be changing. And we have the drizzle of fall on us. Such a perfect time to sit zazen and explore the light. So as many of you know, this tradition of Denkoe Sesshin is an ancient one. Kōbun Chino Roshi, our Zen Center founder, established the Denkoe Sesshin Achikoji, maybe not ever here. Do you know if he ever?
No, never here. Maybe in Los Altos.
Los Altos, maybe. And then I think it's become an annual Jikoji Sesshin. And Kōbun's style was to, I don't know, maybe originally, I think someone was saying that originally he would bring up the Denko Roku, but then in his very creative, unique way, it just evolved into its own expression and wasn't tied to that text. I know Kōbun was, had some connection with light, it seems like. Jikoji is a compassion light temple, and Hokoji in New Mexico is Phoenix Light Temple. Then there's a great calligraphy on the wall at Jikoji, white on black, that says something about light. Turning the light or something. But it seems that Denkoe Sesshin in Japan and still to this day is a time to explore this particular teaching of Keizan, our Zen ancestor, in the record of transmitting the light, the Denko Roku. Similar to Genzoe Sesshin, which we also hold here, where we explore Dogen's Shobo Genzo. So a little bit about Keizan on this, his Memorial Day, his annual memorial, Dogen's and Keizan's Memorial Day. What a great way to celebrate that with a Denkoe Sesshin. Keizan was born 15 years after Dogen died in Japan, so he practiced with Dogen's disciple Ko-un Ejo. And at some point, Ejo died when Keizan was still young, so he went on to practice with Ejo's disciple Tetsu Gikai. And there's some kind of mysterious conflict happened around this time in Soto Zen in Japan. And people still aren't quite sure what happened. But during the time that Tetsu Gikai was abbot at Eheiji, there was squabbling started. You know, we always hear about conflicts in American Zen, and we think, why can't it be like the pure old way in Japan? But I think they had these problems there too. And this was pretty bad. It looks like that the whole Sangha split, and Gikai was actually, you know, thrown out of it was, I think, Eheji. Yeah, Eheji. He was the Eheji abbot. And so he was kind of like, you know, pulled off the abbot seat and somebody else put up there. And so something happened, you know, when Dogen first came, it was just like this fresh new thing. Everyone was so inspired, and Dogen was this amazing character. So there was this great harmony in the Sangha, but just as things evolved, there were power struggles, and different lineages were like mixing together. There was a whole faction that had not originally practiced with Dogen. So there's still, I think scholars aren't exactly sure what happened there. They just call it the third generation conflict of Soto Zen. And things shifted, but this was the time that Keizan lived, because he practiced with Gikai, who was the one who was ousted. So some say that it's partly because of this conflict that, and where this was the only Soto Zen still, right? It was this very new movement in Japan, and it was such a beautiful and precious thing that Keizan didn't want that to just be lost in the conflict. So he, I think he didn't really write, but he spoke this Denko Roku, these teachings on the stories of the ancestors and the lineage, to kind of, some might say legitimize the lineage of Soto Zen, but maybe we could say more like celebrate it and show what a wonderful series of teachings and practices got passed along from the Buddha up to this. Actually, it's the stories of the ancestors up to Kōun Ejo, and maybe Keizan didn't include his own teacher because he was maybe still alive. Celebrating these teachings. And some also say that it's like there's the Bendowa, Dogen's first teaching, really, that we had a class series on here. Kind of setting forth his style of Zen is kind of like an introduction to Dogen's style of Zen. Some people say Denko Roku is kind of like Keizan's, also like this is the quintessential expression of Zen through our particular lineage, because it's the stories of each of these ancestors. But not quite as introductory, we might say also. The Bendowa was written just for anyone. You could say this is also like establishing the unique style of this particular lineage, but in a more, maybe for people who've already been practicing for a while. Keizan also shifted the style of Soto Zen a little bit. And a lot of these may be stories that we, that have, you know, evolved over time. Historically, not sure, we will never know exactly how this all was, but it seems like the current story is that Dogen brought this very, kind of, we could say, pure, austere, simple way of Zen. He really emphasized just sitting. And although Dogen did write quite a bit about ceremonies and different procedures, he didn't seem to maybe establish too much of a routine like that. Or at least we don't have so much record of it. But by the time of Keizan, maybe there was that feeling of, well, now this is like planted here. Zen is planted in Japan, and we need to establish the full extent of Zen tradition. So he brought in, Keizan brought in much more ritual elements. He was into Shingon, influenced by Shingon, which is a Japanese, you could say mantrayana, quite literally, Shingon means true word, and it's the Japanese translation of mantra. So it's the mantra school, Mantrayana, which is another name in Tibetan Buddhism for Vajrayana. So it's the kind of esoteric school of Japanese Buddhism. And this includes, like in its title, mantras and dharanis. Dharani is a form of mantra. So we have kaizans, regulations and guidelines for the monastery. That's not so much rules, actually. It's more like this whole manual of ceremonies. And now we have the modern Sotoshu Gyoji Kihan that we, where our ceremonies pretty much come out of, is very, very similar to Keizan Shingi, it's called. So a lot of our style, our kind of ritual style of Zen in modern times is established by Keizan, it looks like. Keizan founded one of the temples he founded was called Sojiji, which is now, along with Eiji, one of the head temples of Soto Zen. Soji actually is a translation, one of the various translations of Dharani. So it's like Dharani temple. So I think that shows his influence, his kind of esoteric or Mantrayana kind of influence. He was a very visionary character. One of his other records is his dream record. He has these wild dreams about all kinds of different beings coming and relating with him and strange occurrences. And which I think the Dogen was more straightforward. He didn't get into that realm so much. Also, Dogen seemed, Keizan was very close with his mother and seems to have taken care of his mother, put a lot of energy into that in his later life, built a little hermitage for her at the monastery, and I think she was a nun at that time, but very kind to his mother, took good care of her, and also had various women disciples. So did Dogen, but according to one modern scholar, it looks like the first Soto Zen woman ancestor was Ekkyu, Acharya Ekkyu, who was Keizan's disciple. So it may just be that Dogen didn't pass on his lineage to his women students. He didn't live that long. Maybe he just didn't get a chance. So Keizan had several long-term women students and first woman ancestor of Soto Zen. He didn't just find all these stories in all different random places. There were these transmission of lamp records already in China that were like these stories, kind of short biographies and awakening stories of all these ancestors. But like the Keitoku era, it's called Dento Roku, the transmission of the lamp, we could say, is this huge, huge volume, like hundreds and hundreds, thousands actually maybe, of ancestors. It's not at one particular lineage, it's just like, you know, starts with Bodhidharma, or it has the Indian ancestors, and then Bodhidharma through the sixth ancestor, and then as it starts branching out into all these lineages, many, many people, many lineages that died out, it includes all of them. And people compiled these vast piles of lamp records of these stories. So Keizan basically pulled out of that, this one line, you know, it's just all these branching streams, and in this huge volume, he pulled out his own lineage, basically, and just had that direct line. But of course, even within Zen, there's many, many different schools, but Soto Zen actually is always this lineage through Keizan. After Keizan, right after Keizan, it's split out into many, many branches too. So he's kind of establishing this unique style of Dogen Zen and Keizan Zen. And his transmission of light, which I think is interesting, that, you know, it's not the lamp now that's being transmitted, it's the light. The lamp's gone like the vessel or container for the light, but now we're talking about transmission of the light. So it's something even less tangible, right, than a lamp. Like last night, speaking about it, the light, we can't see it. You can see the lamp that holds the light. You could say the teachings that carry the light, but this is something less graspable than a particular set of teachings. And so Keizan's Denko Roku wasn't even published until 1857. So many, many centuries after he lived. The Shobo Genzo also wasn't published until the 1800s. So these were kind of like inner Soto Zen texts that were just, maybe some temples had them, but they weren't read by the general public. Even many priests probably didn't even read them. But then they were kind of published, you know, publicly at pretty recent times. Why that is, seems strange to me, because they're these amazing works. After they were published, they became quite popular. So, as I understand it, I just found some figures from 1991, this Soto Zen lineage that was this new thing in Japan at Keizan's time that they were just struggling to keep alive and kind of establish in this world where there's all these other traditions going on, then grew to be what's currently, as I understand, the largest denomination of Buddhism in Japan, is Soto Zen. Partly because Rinzai Zen has a lot of different branches within it that are counted individually, but I think even if you add them up, and Jodo Shinshu is also very popular in Japan, but as I understand it, Soto Zen, in terms of like numbers of people kind of registered as the religious registration, just, you know, lay people supporting Soto Zen and practicing in that way, is the largest denomination. In 1991, there were 25,000 Soto Zen temples, 30,000 priests, and 10 million followers who consider themselves Soto Zen in Japan. But as you may know, it's like of these 10 million, probably about 5% or less have ever sat Zazen. You know, it's a completely different thing. But still, it would be like that's they know of Dogen and Keizan, and that's where their ancestors are buried in the Soto Zen temple cemetery, and that's their probably passed down through many generations in their family. That's their tradition. So last year we had the first Denko A Sesshin here, and we started with Bodhidharma. Now this, actually the text starts with Shakyamuni Buddha, goes through all the 28 Indian ancestors. Bodhidharma is the 28th. And I hope that, you know, eventually we'll go through the end and then cycle back to the beginning and go through the Indian one. But I thought, that could take years just to get to the Indian ancestors. And there's a different flavor with these Indian stories. They're much more mythological very strange. They often don't involve what we think of as like koan, what became conversations that we now call koans. Some of them do involve conversations, but it's shrouded in the mists of antiquity, so they really don't know about those people so much. But they are wonderful stories, and of course Keizan's commentaries are quite wonderful, but Bodhidharma's where Zen really, you know, maybe we can't even say historically if Bodhidharma really lived, but probably so. I know Andy Ferguson, Chinese scholar and practitioner, really tried to research the life of Bodhidharma and kind of like found out a lot of information. It really looks like it was this particular person. Or maybe a lot of stories about him are not, were made up later, but it looks like there was a person living in that area where we think he lived and doing something kind of new and controversial in his time, and he was not so popular because he was kind of outside the Buddhist institution of his time. And then we have these first six ancestors. Bodhidharma is also called the first Chinese ancestor, down to Huineng. Now there are, in some of these little lamp records, there's some branching streams from like the fourth and fifth ancestors that didn't last. So currently all Zen goes through the sixth ancestor, which again is historically we're not quite sure really who that person was, but it looks like there was somebody like that. And last session we talked about the stories of Bodhidharma through the sixth ancestor. So now we have the first stream of what we call Soto Zen, where things start to branch out from the sixth ancestor. So let's start today with Qing Yuan Xin Shi Seigen Yoshi Daiyosho. So as you all probably know, the sixth ancestor had many, many different students, and really like that's when Zen really started thriving and taking off as its own movement. Bodhidharma was so obscure, no one really knew about him. Only a few people and found him up in his snowy cave. But after the sixth ancestor, something really started churning over there in China. And the two main, I wouldn't even say main disciples, because those are the lineages, the five schools of Zen all branched out from these two, Qing Yuan, or Seigen, and Nan Yue, Nan Gaku. So the Linji Rinzai line came from Nan Yue, and the Soto line, and others came from Qing Yuan. So this is the story about Qing Yuan coming to the sixth ancestor. All these cases are arranged chapters are arranged as the stories presented, the kind of circumstances of their life, the biography, and Keizan's Taisho, or commentary on the story, and then Keizan's verse. So the case is the 34th ancestor was Great Master Hung Chir. He practiced in the community of Shaoqi. Shaoqi is the sixth ancestor. Soke of the So of Soto. He asked the sixth ancestor, "What should I do so as not to land in some class or stage?" The ancestor said, "What have you done so far?" The master replied, the master's always the main ancestor of the story. So Jin Yuan replied, "I've not even tried the Four Noble Truths, or I've not even practiced the Four Noble Truths." The ancestor asked, "Into what stage will you end up?" And the master said, "If I still have not tried the Four Noble Truths, what stage can there be?" And the sixth ancestor was greatly impressed with his potential, or he saw him as a Dharma vessel. So some of these stories are not their pivotal moment of awakening into complete appreciation of the light. In this case, it's just a conversation about being impressed with his potential. And it's about falling into stages or classes or ranks or divisions of practice. So this translation is probably quite accurate because most of the others are very similar. But something seems kind of strange about the story, but often they seem strange. But this one by Kaz Tanahashi sounds a little bit different. Just a slightly different twist. Qing Yuan asked Wei Neng, "What is the work that does not fall into stages?" Wei Neng said, "What have you done?" Qing Yuan said, "I haven't even practiced the sacred truths or noble truths, holy truths." Wei Neng said, "Why isn't that falling into stages?" This is the difference, that particular line. The other one said, "I've not even practiced the Four Noble Truths." And he says, "Into what stage will you end up then, if you haven't practiced this, these Noble Truths? What stage will you end up?" This one is, "I haven't practiced the Noble Truths. Well, why isn't that falling into stages?" Yeah, a little different. It's more like the first one seems like he's saying, "Well, what's the problem then? If you haven't even practiced this, then what stages can you fall into? You're not doing anything, so don't worry." It has more of that feeling. This has more the feeling of, you don't even practice anything at all, but why isn't that falling into stages? It's a little more probing. And Qing Yuan said, "I have not even done anything about the Noble Truths. How can that be called falling into stages?" And Wei Neng said, "Just so, just so. You should maintain it well." So before we get into this issue of stages and falling in, a little bit about the circumstances of Qing Yuan's life. He was from the Liu family of Anchung in Chuzhou. He made his home departure while still young. Whenever he was in a group discussing the way, he remained silent. Later, he heard about the Dharma talks at Cao Chi and went there to pay his respects. He asked, "What should I do so as not to land in some stage?" and so on, as the story goes. Though there were many monks in the community of Cao Chi, of Hui Neng, Qing Yuan was foremost. It was like the second ancestor remaining silent and Bodhidharma saying, "You have acquired my marrow." Maybe you've heard that story about Bodhidharma's four disciples and, it's time for you all to say something to express your practice. And the other three have various responses, and Huike just stands in silence. And Bodhidharma says, "You have attained my marrow." So it looks like Qing Yuan was also a kind of silent type. whenever he was in a group discussing their way, he remained silent. He just listened and didn't try to interject lots of views of his own. One day, Huainong said, "Formerly the robe and bowl were both passed on from master to disciple. The robe represents faith. The Dharma seals the mind. Now I have found you, so why should I worry about being believed?" Kind of like there was this issue of legitimacy and so on. It had these symbolic things that went with it, but like, I'm not worried about having to prove that Dharma is legitimate, that Zen is legitimate anymore now that I have you. So, and also, since receiving the robe, I've run into much trouble. You know, the story is about people trying to steal the robe back, and it became this symbol, and the sixth ancestor had to, like, you know, run away in the mountains, and the warrior monk had to chase him up there and try to steal the fifth ancestor's robe and bowl back. And he's like, so, like, let's stop this ridiculous ordeal at this time, since receiving the robe, I've run into much trouble. This is the sixth ancestor saying, there will certainly be much more contention in later generations. The transmission of the robe will end and thus bring peace to the monastery. You should teach elsewhere and not allow the teaching to be extinguished. So, that particular robe of Bodhidharma is supposedly still enshrined in the stupa at the Six Ancestors Temple. Well, we visited there on a China pilgrimage and they told us that, but we weren't allowed to see it. But that seems to be the idea, is that particular Bodhidharma's robe, like, you know, by this time it would be like totally tattered shreds, right, if they kept passing it along too. So it's just enshrined there, and other robes were passed along. But and maybe controversies still happened, but it wasn't tied to this particular religious artifact anymore. Having acquired the Dharma, the master lived in the Qingchu Monastery on Mount Qingyuan in Zhizhou. So he's named after his mountain, Qingyuan, Mount Seigen. Sharing the teaching with Cao Qi, Huainong. Eventually, after he found Shi To, many others came to follow in his footsteps after joining the Six Ancestors group. He was Huainong's bright light. On the 13th day of the 12th month in 740, so this is a long time ago, the year 740 in China, he appeared in the Dharma hall, spoke to the monks, sat in cross-legged meditation, and expired. Later, he was given the posthumous title of Great Master Hongzhi. A lot of those people like to die in Zazen posture. So, Keizan says, Qingyuan never discussed Buddhism with the crowd, an especially unusual continuous practice in silence. With such power of attention to making a strenuous effort while he was with Cao Qi, he asked what he should do so as not to land in some class or stage. Truly, he experienced the way fully and ended by not having any inclination to go further. The ancestor promptly tried to get him to present his realization, asking, "What have you done so far?" Finally, the point was exposed and not shut up in the needle case. He said, "I've not even practiced the holy truths." Hearing this is hard to hear, and meeting this is hard to meet. Even though you cease continuing, there is still an attachment to the self. And if this is so, you make the mistake of falling into the deep pit of liberation. In the past and present, this situation is called Dharma attachment. Nunmen called this the two sicknesses of the Dharma body. So the issue now is about falling into stages, falling into what is stages? It's like particular realms of attainment or understanding or being of any kind, getting stuck in any particular place. But particularly, it looks like these spiritual practitioners have an issue with getting stuck in spiritual places, these kind of stages. So Yunmen's Two Sicknesses is about this topic of getting stuck in stages. So he doesn't bring it up besides just mentioning it here, but we have this story, case 11 in the Book of Serenity, Yunmen's Two Sicknesses, which I think quite helpfully illuminates this story of Qingyuan getting stuck in stages. And it's also, it seems an appropriate story to bring up at this time because it's about the light. It's when working with the light, getting stuck in various ways that hinder the full appreciation of the light. So Master Yunmen said, when the light does not penetrate freely, there are two kinds of sickness. When the light is not fully appreciated, there are two kinds of sickness. When the light is not intimately transmitted, there are two kinds of sickness. One is when all places are not clear and there is something before you. Now you could take this as just ordinary grasping, stuck mind. But it's often taken as for someone already working with the light, already practicing with the light, and settling more and more deeply into the present, sensing the radiance of the light, but the light's not penetrating freely. It's when all places, or everywhere, all places are not clear and there's something before you. All places are not clear and there's something before you. So, tentatively, I take this as and I have a commentary from my teacher, Tenzin Roshi, about this story. So this is also his take on this, is that that the sense of oneself as a separate, independent being is dropped off, at least to some extent. But there still seem to be things of an external world before us. So all places are not clear, and there's something before us. So there maybe still is some a little bit of a self just in relation to things before us. There's still a belief in external objects. You could say that's one sickness of the light not penetrating freely. And the second is, having penetrated the emptiness of all things, in other words, now there aren't any actual phenomena in front of me and you, still, subtly, it seems like there is something there. This too is the light not penetrating freely. Okay, so this might be, we might say, this is already like getting very advanced here for really like not believing in a deep level of anything outside at all. But I think that Yunmen's being quite strict here. This is an unusual koan too, and some people say this would not be included in like like the Blue Cliff Record is a, you might consider a Rinzai koan collection. It was collected by a Rinzai lineage teacher, and it's very kind of like forceful and direct, we might say. Whereas this Book of Serenity was collected by Soto lineage teacher, and it has a different flavor. Like, it's more exploring these very subtle distinctions and nuances of practice. This is classically said to be one difference between these two styles. Linji being really forceful and like, so what's happening? And just whack! Just a lot of like, just no nonsense, cut through everything, don't try to work out the details, just cut off your head. Whereas Soto Zen is like, no, just very gently, sit very still and, let the weave of the mind become more and more clear. The subtleties of how we perceive and how we separate and grasp and so on. More gentle and careful examination. And this is kind of a generalization, but I think it shows up in the style of practice in these lineages even. So some people say this koan would, you know, is one of these careful examination of subtle details. It's not even about a conversation. It's just even then just talking about these sicknesses. So those are two kinds of sicknesses when the light doesn't penetrate freely. And then Yunmen says, also the Dharma body has two kinds of sickness. The Dharmakaya has two kinds of sickness. Strange to say, because the Dharmakaya is like perfect Buddhahood. It's usually said to be like that. But in Zen, these Zen ancestors can say things. Actually, the Dharma body, the Dharmakaya, has these two kinds of sicknesses. This is really too bad. One is when you manage to reach the Dharmakaya, but because your clinging to Dharma is not forgotten, your sense of self still remains and you fall into the realm of the Dharmakaya. Or your personal view still remains and you fall into the realm of the Dharmakaya. So, traditional teachings would probably say, well, that's not the Dharmakaya then. But, I think he's pointing to, in Zen, maybe we could say the Dharmakaya is just, a really direct openness to complete emptiness. And he's saying, well, you could have that, but still, you manage to reach that, but there's this, clinging is the word, but it seems to be, in this case, we're talking about the Dharmakaya, this is very, almost unnoticeable clinging, and this would be like a sickness that most people wouldn't even know they have. If most, you know, for the very few that even reach the Dharmakaya. So, it's this warning about how, and I think encouragement about how deep this practice can go. That we could have this kind of sickness as a problem. Right? Well, let's just like try to let go of all our grasping mind first and at least approach the Dharmakaya. We shouldn't even be worrying about these sicknesses. And yet, here they are. Because at the point of reaching it, we might not want to hear anything else about how we have any sickness. So like, now we've heard it. It's now stored in our storehouse consciousness. So this little seed might, if we're settling deeply into the Dharmakaya, this little seed might come up and say, like, is there any holding the Dharma? It's clinging to Dharma we're talking about here. And I think it's Dharma is not just even ideas about Dharma at this point. It's like some sense that there's like the Dharma is like the greatest. But, you know, not even in words. I think it's just that finally the Dharmakaya, how wonderful. It's like, no. This is a sickness. And then the second is, even if you can pass through, if you let go, that won't do. Examining carefully, thinking, what breath is there? This too is sickness. Or passing through and letting go completely still won't do. To keep examining to see if there's anything at all, even this breath or this energy. Actually, the word is qi or chi, which is used to translate breath here, but it's the qi of qigong too. So, examining carefully, thinking, what qi can there even possibly be here? It's like beyond even the subtle body, the qi body. What could there possibly be? Amazing. To, you know, that thought, and not even like a conscious thought, but like that mind of how incredibly wonderful. I can't even find the subtle qi body. I can't even find the breath. This too is sickness. To let the mind just ask such a question. Or we could even say, like completely non-attached, completely not grasping, and kind of the question being, what could possibly be lacking now? That little voice that's asking, like, how could anything possibly go beyond this? Everything completely complete. That too is a sickness. Not even saying it, but just even asking, like, how could there be anything more? You know, it's like the end, period. Even feeling such a way is a little sick. Sick in the sense that the light is not penetrating freely when the light's completely penetrating freely. These things are not an issue. You know, not being able to find a last little trace of anything. Not even an issue. And that's the realm where then in Zen, the the end of the story is not like what possible little bit of breath could there even be here. It's more like, you know, this sickle cost 5 cents. And like, it's like fully immersing in the everyday world is the final culmination where the light really penetrates freely. It's no longer attachment to the holy Dharma as removed from the ordinary world. So can you see how Yunmen's story about two kinds of sickness and then two kinds of sickness of the Dharmakaya is actually about getting stuck in falling into stages and different degrees of realization or attainment. So we don't know what conversations they had before this conversation in the story, but it may be the first time that they met. How wonderful for Qing Yuan to come and say right off the bat, instead of like, how can I realize the Dharmakaya? How can I not see anything before me? Instead he says, how can I not fall into some stage or practice? And it's also not like, you know, for years and years I've been practicing with the Four Noble Truths. I've been working with really, you know, we have these practices with the Four Noble Truths that when we chant the Buddha's first teaching, the, you know, as long as these 12 aspects, these three ways of each of the Four Noble Truths is not fully clear, then the Buddha says, I did not claim to have realized the perfect awakening that is supreme in the world. And they are the full understanding of suffering. That's like, you could say, the practice. How do you practice the Four Noble Truths? Well, there's like, with the First Noble Truth of suffering, there's the practice of fully understanding suffering. This Noble Truth must be fully understood. And this Noble Truth has been fully understood. Such was the vision, the knowledge, the wisdom, the awareness, the light that arose in the Buddha, not heard before. And the second Noble Truth is the craving, which produces renewal of being. Craving and grasping at a self and at all things, ultimately. And this Noble Truth must be abandoned. That's a practice of the Second Noble Truth. Suffering, it's not just that we hear suffering, it's like we can actually practice really understanding what it is. Like, well, I understand suffering, but in the Buddha's teaching, like really examining what is it that we actually call suffering. And when the Buddha defines it as in brief, basically it is grasping the five aggregates as me. So what does that really mean? It is, you know, understanding really what that means. And then the second, the grasping and the craving that produces this relinquishing, letting go, dropping off is the practice. The third truth of cessation must be fully realized. So the realization is the practice the practice and realization of cessation are not two. And then there's the path leading to cessation. The path must be followed or practiced. The Noble Eightfold Path is practiced, and that realizes the cessation of suffering. What a gift that Buddha's teaching. So simple and straightforward, so profound at the same time. You can spend a lifetime practicing the Four Noble Truths in this way. And then we have this strange Zen tradition where this person, Qin Yuan, left home at an early age in order to just practice the way. Well, isn't the way to practicing the Four Noble Truths? It seemed like he had already been practicing, it looks like. I don't think he's like just starting off here. He may be, but I take it as he's already been diligently practicing, and he comes to the sixth ancestor and says, what should I do so as not to land in some stage resulting from my practice? And the ancestor says, well, what have you done? I've not even practiced the Four Noble Truths. Well, we could say, well, why not? Isn't that the path to the realization of the cessation of suffering? As long as those Four Noble Truths were not fully clear, the Buddha says, I could not claim to have realized the perfect awakening, the stage of perfect awakening that is supreme in the world. Supreme, like, you know, better than any other stages below that. I cannot claim that at that time. So there's something about the Zen style here that's like, I wouldn't say rejecting the Four Noble Truths, because I think it's the basis of all these teachings. And yet, I haven't even practiced these Four Noble Truths. I haven't really examined and understood suffering. I haven't really dropped off all craving that's the basis of it. I haven't really realized cessation, and I haven't really practiced, followed the path. And yet I'm still, my concern here is not for you to teach me how to practice the Four Noble Truths, but how to not fall into any stage or attainment of practice or resulting from practice. What have you done so far? I haven't even practiced the Four Noble Truths. The ancestor asked, well then, into what stage will you end up? Or, what stage does that fall into? Well, if I haven't even practiced the Four Noble Truths, what stage can there be? Let me stop and see if you'd like to bring up anything or question anything about this story.
Well, Suzuki Roshi famously said that everyone's practice is the same. And we don't, you know, talk so much about, you know, the different different jhana states or the 10 bodhisattva levels, you know, which I'm sort of thinking of like stages.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, nobody that I know says, you know, I'm at number 4. It's just, you know, the tide comes in and the zendo fills up at 5:45 in the morning and the bell rings and the tide goes out and everybody kind of just takes that 40 minutes of letting thoughts go, stillness to kind of perfume the rest of their day. I think Suzuki was pointing more towards sincerity of practice than level or stage of practice. And that's what I hear from this ancestor, that you know, this sitting was alive for him in the way that it's alive for the people who come here day after day. And so he was asking the master, you know, am I doing it right? Should I be getting any more? Is there something else that I should be looking at? Is there another stage? Are some of the senior people meditating differently, or are they at a different stage?
But he's already saying, what can I do so as to not fall into any stage?
I guess that's just my kind of riff on stages.
What about
we talk more about, you know, sincerity of practice and how it's alive for us.
Hmm. Do you think there could be stages of sincerity? Get into that, right? It's like you could say, how can I not fall into the stages? It's like not discriminating. How can I really not discriminate? And maybe he was like already had been working with discriminating amongst like, I kind of like doing that, I don't like doing this, and I like when that happens and not that. Maybe he'd already worked with that and it's like, no, I really want to work on my discrimination in this practice realm. And how can I I really don't want to discriminate amongst any stages of practice in the most deep way to, you know, I'm so sincere about not falling into any stage that I'm not even going to practice the Four Noble Truths. Or, you know, maybe it is really, you know, could say, there was really working with those Four Noble Truths, but like the principles behind them, these people, of course, are, it's impossible not to get in touch with our suffering. And if we watch it long enough, we start to understand how it does arise. And by understanding how it arises, we start to see how by not giving rise to those conditions, it doesn't arise in the same way. And that is the path. So there's something very natural about it, but it's a very natural unfolding of the mind to open in that way, and yet to avoid falling into stages, he says, I haven't even practiced these Four Noble Truths. Like, I don't get into even delineating them like this, and like, I'm working with this one now, and then this one now, and this one now. So I think when you say like our practice, we're all doing the same practice, and that the spirit of we're not getting into like better or worse and all that. Like that is one of the main principles of the story. Not discriminating in stages of practice. And the more sincere we are about practice, often the more we start to think in terms of these stages. We're like, how am I doing? You know, I don't want to waste my time. So, am I making progress? If I'm really sincere, shouldn't I be seeing signs or something? And I think it's about these questions. And that that he's not even... that this ancestor is really concerned about not falling into those things that are so normal for a person to fall into. Yes, Diana.
Well, it's really striking to me how similar this conversation is to the conversation between Tozon and Yun Yen, when Tozon says to him, you know, I still have some bad habits that aren't quite, you know, fixed yet or removed yet. And Yun Yen says, well, what have you been doing? He says, I haven't even practiced the Four Holy Truths.
Yeah.
And Yun Yen says, well, are you joyous in this non-practice? And Tozon says, yeah, there's happiness in it. So...
I think maybe he says something like, it's not that I'm not joyful.
Right. He said, yeah, I've seen it both ways. Mm. Yeah, the more Andy translates it as, it's not lacking in joy or something. But it just strikes me that the two issues are really similar.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, trying to make myself different, fit in to some idea about practice or about how I'm supposed to be, and he was actually toward the end of his training when he said that. So he's kind of cleaning up the last few vestiges of whatever he thinks is left.
Mm-hmm.
And his teacher says, well, are you joyous?
Mm-hmm.
So is this really an early dialogue sort of discerning or distinguishing Zen practice from former... because Tozon authored the five ranks. But here he is having this conversation. You know, I mean, it's just interesting.
Yeah.
So they're discerning that there's something different in this way,
mm-hmm.
and yet still in the paradox of it, still in the human mind, which wants to rank things. And I don't know. It's interesting that 150 years later, the same conversation plays out.
And probably had heard of this conversation. So that's how these things do get passed along. And but in the same lineage too, right? So that's something about about our particular style is like we don't even practice the Four Noble Truths. and about particularly also about not falling into stages and so on. I think it is. It's actually part of our style.
Not getting anywhere and
say it's it. And even to compare it to Rinzai style, where it's like, I think a lot of these same principles are surely there also, but it's easier to get in if you're going through a koan system and you're like progressing through these stages of koan practice, and there are these like different types of koans that become more and more advanced. It really, even though it's ultimately not about stages, it has that trap built in to think that way. So our style is so free from that. It's so beginning to end. Like Dogen says, you know, the very beginner's mind practice and realization is not different from at the end. In Bendawa, he talks about beginners and advanced practice, and the Zazen is the same throughout. Now we could say, well, what are we talking about Zazen there? We could also say, but in a clear moment of non-doing zazen, however short or long that lasts, it's the same throughout. And I think we really emphasize the sameness and talking about, as we were talking about last night with the, the stars and the sun and so on, is more as a metaphor, because the spiritual light, the light that's transmitted here, is not physical light, and yet as far as metaphors go, it can be taken pretty far. Physical light, the sense that you can't see it, but you can see the objects that it's reflected off of. So the light that's not the physical light is like that too, that we can't see it, but we can see its reflections. And opening to this light, so that's one place where the metaphor breaks down, is that it doesn't matter if you're blind with this kind of light that we're talking about. The eyes don't need to be open to receive it, the physical eyes. So how to practice with that? Well, the light is by definition inconceivable, so it's not like we're going to, which is why physical light's a nice metaphor, because it can't actually be grasped or seen even directly. And yet opening to this inconceivable light that that nourishes us and makes us appear as we are. As Edgio said in the absorption in the treasury of light that we're exploring last night, is to just cast body and mind into this great treasury of light. So it's an image, and that points us towards something. But again, it's not so straightforward as a physical activity. We can just take our body and mind and put it into the treasury of light. It's like, but these words, treasury of light, evoke some spirit of, evoke a kind of direction towards which we can intend or direct our practice. So that's the kind of Zen, that's one thing that seems about Zen, like this story, that's different from more straightforward earlier teachings. Like Beata was saying, it seems maybe this is starting to distinguish the style of Zen as opposed to these earlier teachings that were like, well, here's some practices you can do, which I think are valuable too, like the Four Noble Truths. We can really, like, if we're suffering, if we feel as if we're experiencing discontent, to really in Zazen examine what that is and examine like where it's coming from, and see, and examine if we see the source where it's coming from, if we can relinquish that you know, source, that thing that's feeding it, if we can just like look at that really clearly and basically just stop. Or as Edgar said, it's not about trying to stop thoughts, it's just simply not giving rise to another thought. So it's an inconceivable practice, and I think we find in our own experience how we open to it more and more. Maybe that doesn't feel like much. Maybe that doesn't feel like much to go on.
Oh, that's good.
Not physical light, and yet something about the metaphor of light that can open our mind and heart to this inconceivable gift that's like flowing into us and reflecting off of us and making us appear as what we think of as me. It's like the light reflecting on something makes this appearance of me. If it weren't for the light, we wouldn't actually be able to even think this is me. But me is not the light. He is just a reflection from the light.
What other translations the word light, what other words can you say as far as some of the characters or whatever?
Yeah. But this character, both in this case, the transmission of light, there's a calligraphic form of it, Ko in Japanese. So it's the first character of my name, Kokyo. Light owl. I say luminous owl, so we could say luminosity. It could also be a verb or an adjective. Luminous, luminosity, light, and so it's quite straightforward and it means like it's used as like physical light in Japan, just like in English, and in Edjo's treasury of light, Komyo Zo, that's the same Ko, and combined with Myo also means light, or like light brightness or luminous brightness. And that one, that Myo light is made up of the two characters for sun and moon put together. So it's like sun and moonlight all mixed together into brightness. And also Komyo is used for what we call like a halo on a Buddha. Like you see that circle of light, it's called the Komyo. It's like which is a whole other interesting area where it's like, we could call it an aura or something. It seems like lots of different spiritual traditions, not just Buddhism, have this luminous kind of effervescent quality like around their bodies and heads. And now is that physical light, or is it the light that we're talking about here? In a way, it's not really the light we're talking about here, because the light we're talking about here, as Edgyo says in that absorption in the treasury of light, when he's talking about the light, he says it doesn't come and go, it's not more in Buddhas, it's not less in sentient beings. It's not when you're born, the light is not born. These are some clues about the light. When you're born, the light's not born. When you die, the light doesn't die. The light's not more in Buddhas, not less in sentient beings. That's already like, wow. It doesn't change. It doesn't come and go. And then he says in a very grandmotherly way, it is the totality of everything. Does not penetrate freely. There are two kinds of sickness. When that which doesn't come and go, that which is not more in Buddhas, that's just the same actual, that same character, Ko, is the same one that Yunmen uses. And when the light doesn't penetrate freely, when that which doesn't come and go with Buddhas and sentient beings is not more or less in enlightenment or delusion, it doesn't get born with us and doesn't die with us, when that light doesn't penetrate freely, there are these kinds of sickness. And if we forgot what they are, we don't need to worry about falling into these stages of sickness elimination. We can just cast body and mind into the great treasury of light and don't look back. May the light that penetrates everywhere freely penetrate everywhere freely for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.